Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the tailgate podcast. I am Terry Foley, joined once again by Nick Osello. Nick, it appears Larkin is in the penalty box for whatever it was that Phil did on Saturday night in order to cause or respond to that fight.
Yes. Two things. One, I am nothing if not hypocritical, and me having missed some episodes this season, and this being, you know, one of the episodes that Larkin has to miss, let me start off by saying, Larkin, inexcusable. You got to make it regardless of your team's outcome. Now, granted, my team's, won every game that they've played in this season, so I don't know what it's like to try and record after your team loses this year. And then I'll cap that with, if you haven't seen it, go and look up Phil Kemp's fight and then subsequent game misconduct. Really cool. I feel like Larkin talks about that a lot, in group chats when something warrants the discussion, but stays pretty silent about it. So I'll promote, go watch Phil Kemp's fight. It's awesome.
Larkin and Phil Kemp, not the only ones in the penalty box. You are in the proverbial penalty box after your Lenten resolutions took a little bit of a hiatus on Saturday. So we're gonna forgive. What are we calling it? 70% Nick Osello performance today?
70%. Although, if you ask any of my teammates from college, what was Nick better at than most, it would be hungover lacrosse, like especially those spring games, or not spring games, sorry, fall games, where, you know, you have the fall scrimmage and, you know, it's just you guys. So, you know, who knows? Maybe I find something that I haven't found since college and put on the performance for the ages.
Well, fortunately, this is, it's not a unique podcast, not a unique week in the college lacrosse season. I'm going to call it like a bridge. It's a bridge from the beginning to the first half to the second half. And it's, you know, we're recording it on March 15th. We're recording it at coming up on 11 a.m. Sunday because there are no Sunday games. And there was only one Friday game, which was Hofstra Stony Brook. There were a pair of Thursday games, which were both unique and welcomed as Ohio State won a slugfest against Denver and then Syracuse pulled away from Air Force late. And then we've got another good one on Monday as the Orange take on the Pios, who were in Columbus on Thursday and now travel home to host Syracuse. So point being, it was a heavy Saturday slate. I was at the IAC Interact Challenge, which was hosted by Episcopal High School in beautiful Alexandria, Virginia, which was a mistake that I made on Twitter yesterday. So apologies to all of the Alexandria denizens. But it was a great day. As a result, didn't get to watch as much college lacrosse as I normally do. However, on we forge. And in some respects, the slate offered a little bit more narrative discussion than maybe tactical discussion for the second week in a row. So apologies if you're here for the nitty gritty nuts and bolts, X's and O's. We'll return to the originally scheduled programming next week and beyond. But we got to start in College Park, where the Maryland Terrapins survived a 3-overtime thriller against the Virginia Cavaliers and emerged with a 3-3 record as a result. However, may be a little bit of a Pyrrhic victory as, I guess because Bobby Van Buren was the co-defensive player of the year, he's missing the season due to injury, and Will Schaller was the other co-defensive player of the year. The reigning defensive player of the year sustained an injury in overtime, did not return. And Coach John Tillman post-game talked about potentially needing an MRI in order to further evaluate what appeared to be a knee injury. Talked about it in the context of hyperextension versus meniscus versus PCL versus ACL. So certainly hoping that the worst is avoided there. But yeah, Zach Whittier in a little bit of a give-and-go situation, coming lefty from behind the crease, gets topside and ends it over the Cavaliers. One of the reactions to the narrative side of this game was Lars Tiffany in post game talking about how they had turned their season around because their defense got so buttoned up as the second half wore on, certainly in both context and reaction to not just the performances that they had put in and their losses to Towson and Johns Hopkins, but also maybe a little bit of the narrative that emerged over the course of the week to which we contributed as well. Larkin, what do you got on Maryland's win over Virginia? Larkin. Oh, my goodness.
Larkin doesn't have anything on it because he's not here. Terry, I'm Nick.
Nick, what do you got on Maryland over Virginia?
You know, I think the low-hanging fruit was heading into this going, it's a much-needed identity-defying game for both sides of the team, or for both teams. And I kind of rejected that when, you know, kind of as the season progressed to this point. I thought this was a must-win for Maryland, and I thought it was a statement opportunity win for Maryland. And when I say statement opportunity, it doesn't mean a three overtime game against what we now know to be, I don't want to say mediocre, but not very good and loss prone UVA team. In years past, there's just been the 12-8 consistency that Maryland can bring to elite level opponents, regardless of how that opponent is playing. But you can't deny that Virginia has loaded talent all over the place, and Maryland has kind of defined themselves as a great system to be a part of. I think Maryland needed to win this 12-8. Schaller goes down. Virginia finds another way to snag defeat out of the jaws of victory. And to me, this kind of solidified my thoughts for both teams. You know, Virginia could not have more red flags, panic alerts. We've talked about that ad nauseum. And Maryland, I just don't see, especially with Schaller being down, and we wish him all the best, of course, I don't see this being the win that they needed to convince anybody that they could be a Final Four team. I'm kind of ready to write both teams off given this, you know, given this result. Are you?
Writing off, I think, is a little bit strong. But at the same time, I agree with you that I don't think this was a panacea for the Terps. I think that what this suggests is this is going to be a slog all year long, right? I think if you were a Maryland fan, even after a underwhelming win over Delaware, you could have still said something to the effect of, you know, we had close losses to three of the best teams in the country. Once we turn the corner, we're going to build momentum and it'll feel like a snowball rolling downhill. And they haven't turned the corner yet. I'm not saying that it's impossible that they won't, but you got Penn State coming up off of a loss, one of the best, you know, kind of non-rivalry rivalries, I would say, within the Big Ten, right? Obviously, Maryland's rival is Johns Hopkins. You know, Michigan has always played them tough, but there's something about, you know, the Maryland-Penn State meetings that feel like pinnacle, meaning like this is kind of stylistically defining what Big Ten lacrosse is. And it's in State College in Panzer Stadium, which is one of the more difficult places to play. And you've got an Nittany Lion squad that we're about to talk about is coming off of a loss that they very justifiably could be pissed off about. And so as a result, you know, I don't think things get easier for the Terps. And, you know, equivalently in the context of Virginia, I mean, you know, what we talked about last year was the path to the NCAA tournament closed very early. I want to be clear, like, the path to the NCAA tournament is not yet closed for Virginia. They can still get there. The wins are available to them. The issue is the path for enough improvement available? And Lars has won two national championships since he got to Charlottesville. You know, we discussed it. It was really well established on the show last week. There is a slice of potential outcomes where it's like, it's not prudent to bet against it until it doesn't come to fruition, right? But at the same time, we're analysts. Nobody comes here for obvious takes like, yeah, the season's not over. There's still time to salvage the operation. So I think the question that I would have is, you know, let's dive in on the reality of what limiting Maryland to 13 goals means, right? And I understand it was a 74-minute game and you're really emphasizing the latter, I don't know, 36 minutes of that or whatever. You know, but at the same time, Delaware held them to 13, right? Notre Dame held them to 8. Princeton held them to 12. Syracuse held them to 9. So 13 might be an improvement, right, for Virginia, and that's what should be focused on. But in terms of what it says, in terms of the overall landscape, I still don't think it's that much to get excited about.
And one of the narratives that was interesting to me in this game, and I'm kind of going to defer to you because I could speak on it, but I think you could speak on it more eloquently and with more actual data that's going on in that big old brain you got. ACC versus Big Ten takeaways. You know, that to me was, oh, it's a notch in the Big Ten's belt. We're talking about this in the context of this being a bridge episode.
Right.
And a lot of the tournament discussion the past years was sparked when the Ivy League got in way too many teams a couple years ago. Talk to me about what this means for ACC versus Big Ten. And then, you know, if you want to throw in Ivy as well.
Yeah, it's the right context to look at it through. And, you know, without having done a deep dive, you know, the point about a bridge is Ivy League competition started this weekend. Big Ten play starts next weekend. The ACC, because it has fewer teams, you know, and also doesn't backload where they force everybody to play their last games against each other. You know, it has a little bit more of a stagger in terms of getting going, but there is still more non-conference wins to be had. So when it comes to evaluating the RPI, the kind of place that I come back to is, are there clusters of conference teams that illustrate what's going to happen when these teams all start playing each other? And the point or question that you asked was, how does the cross-conference standings, results, whatever the case may be, influence or impact the way in which that kind of virtuous cycle, you would call it, lay out? And so, you know, I mean, there's still some anomalies that are a little bit head scratching. Boston U now up to number 5, right? We talked about this in the context of Army coming mm-hmm. off of the Lafayette loss. They didn't drop that far. You know, they have now dropped to 8. For the Patriot League to have two teams in the top 10, I'm not saying it puts them firmly in two bid league conversation, but we've got Richmond at 6, St. Joe's at 10. That's the A-10, also in the, you know, precipice of a two-bid league conversation. As far as the ACC is concerned, you've got Syracuse at 2, Notre Dame at 3, Duke at 4. That's pretty familiar. Carolina at 9, and then, you know, Virginia, where? All the way down at 35.
Scroll down.
So whereas on the Big Ten side, Hopkins currently sitting at 7, Rutgers at 12, Ohio State at 15, Penn State at 17, Maryland 18, and Michigan at 39. Point being, the ACC is going to get its normal benefit of playing each other. The Patriot League and A-10 are going to throw a monkey wrench in, especially if Richmond does not win the A-10 AQ. And then the Big Ten is not going to get its normal benefit of everybody playing each other because that threshold, that cluster in that, you know, call it 18 to 20 range, that's not doing anybody any good from the standpoint of you want to be a top 8 or really more like a top 11 or 12 finisher in RPI in order to feel good on Selection Sunday, depending on how all the other bid stealers shake out. So point is, this is not as out of the ordinary as 2022 was in terms of the way that the Ivy League clustered at the top, right? With, I think, 6 teams in the top 12 or so around this time before conference play began. But it is unusual. It actually really reminds me of what we saw a lot in the 2010s. I'm sorry, in the 2000s, late 2000s, when you would have the non-ACC. I mean, the Big Ten didn't exist, right? So the the way in which, you know, bids were a little bit more evenly spread out outside of the ACC between the CAA, Patriot League, GWLL. If you remember in 2008, they got two at-larges and the Big East, right? So you would basically see three or four of the at-larges go to the ACC, and then one or so each of the others go to the other four or five conferences that were vying for it. This actually has a little bit of shades of that in a way that I don't think we've seen since, at the very least, when the Big Ten was formed in 2015.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to defer to you. Sorry, my brain's holding on for dear life there,
Terry. Well, let's keep with the...
Because my initial reaction is just like, holy smokes, I can't believe how much you remember about the selections over the past decades. So really impressive, but sounds like we should just move on to what people were getting mad about online.
Yeah, let's hear it. Nothing gets you more excited than people being mad online.
And I'm unfortunate that I was offline last night, fumbling around with Twizzlers in a movie theater. But
it's not a euphemism, to be clear. That is a legit, what happened.
No, that was actually what happened. If you're wondering what a crazy night looks when you're 32, it's struggling to open up candy in a movie theater. People are looking at you after you break your Lenten promise. Different story for a different day. Terry, people were really mad online at one Booker Corrigan. Why?
Yeah.
Why?
So North Carolina beat Penn State 10-8 at the Crown Lacrosse Classic, which is in Charlotte, American Legion Memorial Stadium. I would imagine you played there a time or two, right?
Yep.
Against the Charlotte Hounds. And then also, I think PLL may have visited there, but that might have been after you retired. Really cool venue. Chris Schiller runs the event. You might recognize him as a Penn State alum, a member of the 2010 U.S. men's national team that won gold against Canada in Manchester, England, regained pride for the United States after losing in 2006. And one of the reasons that he was selected for that team as a short 60 midi was because of how much NLL experience he had and how that created familiarity with not just the personnel that Canada was going to bring to the table, but also this was a big talking point in 2009. And was a significant factor in selecting Kevin Cassis and Matt Zash, right? The kind of designated D middies that were familiar with Mike Pressler, but also Sean Natalin, who was recovering from an ACL and did so in pretty record time because, again, of his familiarity within the NLL. And then Eric Martin, the defenseman from Salisbury, who also had an MLL career but played in the NLL as well. And there was just so much emphasis put on the need to handle these Canadian two-man games because of how deadly they proved in 2006. But with all that being said, Chris Schiller, a really strong advocate for lacrosse in Charlotte, has hosted this Crown Lacrosse Classic for a long time. I don't want to try to guess at the number of years. And partnered with Corbin Sports Enterprises to host the live stream. When a game is taken off campus, the media rights tend to open up, meaning that when it's on campus, whether it's the ACC network or the Big Ten with BTN Plus, whatever the case may be, that tends to be how the broadcast or the stream works. But for a neutral site venue, you can kind of go with a different operator, especially in a sport like lacrosse where there isn't going to be a clamoring for most of these from the traditional broadcasters who have paid a rights fee. So Corrigan Sports comes in, of course, Booker Corrigan, one of the more legendary voices in the game, known for his one-liners that go incredibly viral. At one point, North Carolina scores a goal off of a sequence that ends with a Dom Petrimella shot. But earlier in the sequence, the question was whether James Madden had stepped into the crease. So we are now three seasons into video review, and it works in a pretty standard way. The officials utilize the broadcast stream when available, as opposed to the coach's film, for the ability to review, because it is almost always inherently going to be of a higher quality. And in this case, it certainly was that. You know, this is a multi-camera shot with a TriCaster production, the ability to, you know, utilize multiple angles, utilize slow-mo ramps, all that sort of stuff in order to be able to evaluate the sequence. Burger Corgan is a character. That is an important pretext to this. And if he listens to this, love you, book. This is all, you know, just in my analytical point of view. If you listen to his commentary on the stream, it sounds like he is either directing the officials on what to watch and advising them, or he is actually making the call that gets passed down and implemented on the field. So the officials themselves, Peter Buchanan, John McDade, like they're not allowed to comment publicly on this. I've reached out to Tom Abbott, who's part of the head of the officials, for comment. Haven't received word back here at 11:07 a.m. Eastern time on Sunday morning. But that being said, I know on good authority from at this point, probably five or six different sources, like that characterization that, you know, Booker was involved in the actual call on the field is not accurate. It was commentating, right? He was doing the commentating for the audience, but in a way that sounded like it had a role in the official proceeding. There was talkback between the officials and the truck. So they were able to request what angles they wanted to see. And then they saw it and they made the call, you know, ultimately based on, you know, what it looked like as just a viewer at home. It appeared that Madden didn't step in the crease based on the best available, angles that were shown on the stream, and the goal stood and we moved on. And I should add, it is pretty wild how often Penn State is involved in these crease calls. And again, how frequently, unanimously it seems, they go against the Nittany Lions. But also 2-0 game, right? You know, I don't like to play the revisionist role of like, oh, well, because of the 2-0 game, that means the one goal, if it should have been disallowed and were, it still wouldn't have mattered in the outcome. Everybody that's ever played sports knows that that's not the way that these types of things should be parsed out. But yeah, just a wild night on Twitter, aided by the fact that not only did Booker say this on the broadcast and the clip got shared, he also then went on Twitter and basically ten-tupled down on the fact that he actually had a role in the review, which is just a fundamental mischaracterization of what actually happened. Like, what happened is what always happens. The officials have the ability to talk to the truck and then ask for, they get a monitor on the field, usually an iPad, and they can ask the director to show them particular angles. And that's, to my understanding, what happened. Nick, your thoughts?
I hate how much I am a fly or a moth drawn to the proverbial light of people getting upset on Twitter.
I can tell that you're looking at Twitter right now to see all of this. You're just so excited for this podcast to end so that you can just roll around in the muck.
I will be doing that because I was monitoring the situation last night, I think is what we call both what civilians do for the emerging Middle East debacle, and that's what I do in lacrosse Twitter. We monitor the situation. And to your point, like having had experience and currently being a broadcaster, like understanding a little bit more about how the back end works and who the truck is talking to and the producer and kind of how it's all connected at the hip, I'm a little surprised it's taken this long to have something like this happen, whether it's a hot mic, a broadcaster helping out with coordination, you know, producer not canceling mics, whatever it might be. I feel like, you know, there was always gasoline associated with video review. That's been just kind of the history of sports. But the beauty with which this came together, going against Penn State, the everybody doing the revisionist history, because the ultimate game, 10-8, two-goal game, that could have had an impact, arguably. And it being one of the all-time characters, it was the perfect storm to get people mad. And, really the only takeaway that I have from all of this is it's fun to be mad online. And until proven otherwise, I assume that it's like handled in the appropriate way. I think broadcasting and referee review decisions are the two easiest things that people who are sitting on the couch can play armchair referee and they can play armchair broadcaster. So when all of those converge at the same time, it's almost the perfect social media debacle, because everyone typing and everyone watching thinks that they can do it better than the people that have been in the booth and on the field refereeing for years. And, now to talk lacrosse for a second, God forbid, what I think the point I was trying to make in Virginia and Maryland is I don't see a path in which they're better than a team to the extent that they can get a win in any aspect of the game. This is a down game for UNC's offense, but it showed the balance that they have in getting to 10, in not just relying on, Duffy and Petro, even though Duffy, I think, had 1-1. This, to me, solidified UNC, even though 10 goals isn't a lot on paper. It showed how deep and how dangerous their offense is and how much of a handful they're going to be for any defense, regardless of who has the ability to pop off that game. I think it's UNC and Princeton and then a cliff and then every other offense.
And that's really well said. Just two points that I want to build on top of it are Brady Wambach, for me, midseason first team All-American, not a surprise because he was a preseason first team All-American, but we've talked about how, Johnny Mullen hasn't had the season that we might have expected coming off of last year. Andrew McMeekin has had exceptional games, but also really struggled in others. 14-22, didn't dominate, right? So I'm gonna say 64% is going to, that's gonna solidify that first team midseason All-America claim, especially against what I consider to be a very good duo in Reed Gills and Kobe Baldwin, who improved dramatically over the course of 2025 and have played really well so far in 26. So, but by the same token, not dominating. 64% is really good, but not dominant, right? So you can't just say that it was a possession-based outcome, where sometimes you can, right? And then equivalently, this was not a goalie-based outcome. Josh Marcus, 7 saves, 8 goals allowed. Preston Hawkins, 8 saves, 10 goals allowed. Basically, both guys were, at 45%. So it wasn't a goalie-led outcome either. It was, I think, fair to call a slugfest. And in the same way that we've talked about some of these results early in the season as being, like, not discouraging, Penn State, we basically said throw away the Villanova results, and I feel vindicated based on, some of the wins that they got in the wake of that. They should be frustrated by the Navy result because they didn't have the hullabaloo or early in the season of it all in order to explain it away. This is not a result that they should be frustrated by. It's a result that they should be disappointed by. And that's why, again, they should be pissed off, especially when you add in if the team, which I would assume they know a little bit more about the reality, feels like there was another kind of misapplication of the rules, then either way, that should just add fuel to the fire. That's never really been Jeff Tamburoni's style, in terms of at least what I understand about how he motivates. So either way, they shouldn't, that losing by 2 in what was a slugfest against North Carolina, for me, if you're Penn State, says this shows that we are within spitting distance of being a Final Four quality team, despite being 4-3.
Yep, very, very much agree. And the final point that I'll make on this is I think Larkin's point, particularly about Notre Dame, was really well received in the departure of the Kavanaughs, like the game that they're emerging to, their preferred style of win is kind of that low scoring rock fight, defensive stranglehold. So looking at Penn State's body of work and how they put up 19 on Cornell yesterday or last week, and then kept it very close with North Carolina. And, you know, I'm sure their fan base is adding asterisks to that. It's just, it's weird how good they are against the Ivy and very close with other quality teams. Penn State to me is defining the, oh, if we pull them in the first round, even if, you know, they're not seeded and we'll see how things play out, that's the team that everyone's going to want to avoid, because the variety with which they can beat you is just not quite to where UNC's is, but it's not far behind.
Let's take a little bit of an interlude in honor of the Oscars, which are tonight. And I'm actually excited about it. I've had what I would characterize as three movie phases in my life, one in high school, one in college. And I'm in the midst of my third right now. I've watched most of these Oscar contenders this year. And really the explanation is my brother visited, and when he left, he didn't log out of HBO Max, which I just for no reason have never paid for before. So now I get to, that's like half of them are on HBO Max. So I was like, all right. And the best performance is the Tewerton. The whole theme that I have characterized in the preseason and so far through 7 weeks of college lacrosse is this is the most wide open, and it's the most wide open because it had the fewest returning offensive stars, which is the pathway to not only consistency, but also winning championships. And my contention is that to the extent that we do have, you know, emerged, established offensive stars, it's Joey Spallina, and there's like both between Syracuse's team performance and then, you know, Joey's performances in, you know, some of these high level games, like he certainly hasn't separated himself from the field. So it's time to take a little bit of a dive into who are the like bona fide Tewerton contenders. And as in keeping with the spirit of this show, I will concede I have done almost no preparation, but I do think it'll be interesting to just go through the exercise of essentially how you start to set the table for what's going to unfold, all right? So I go to stats.ncaa.org, and I navigate to Men's Division I Lacrosse, update it for games through, oh boy, March 12th. That's not going to help us very much.
And while you adjust that, I will just say what's been the most fun is realizing how far behind ChatGPT is and how many essays about lacrosse in the middle school and high school ranks right now are just going to be terrible. So as a, in preparation, knowing that this was going to be kind of a topic, I was like, I'm legitimately curious what ChatGPT has as this year's Tewerton information. After a bunch of horse crap and, you know, hundreds of gallons of water, it says my ballot if voting today. Now this is for 2026. I explicitly said 2026. ChatGPT would vote for CJ Kirst.
Yep.
Then Joey Spallina, then Jake Taylor, then Logan McNaney. So honestly, we can't rule out CJ Kirst. I mean, what the heck? So that just a reminder, don't use ChatGPT for anything lacrosse related. I tried it once for episode prep earlier this year. It would teach the worst. It's so bad, it's kind of fun.
Also, don't use NCAA's website on Sunday is the lesson that we can learn. But McKay Millen was leading the country in scoring heading into this. Rory Connor was third. Timmy Shanahan was fourth. Ryan Stein's fifth. Joey Spallina, sixth. In terms of other guys who are going to be in the mix because of where their teams currently sit, Jack Spiedel at 4.8 points per game, Owen Duffy at 4.71, Aiden O'Neill at 4.67, Mikey Weishaar also there, Willem Firth at 4.6. So for me, I think, you know, that's a pretty good cluster of what like reasonable expectations should be. Obviously, we know that this is an offensive player award, but I always like to make sure to check out save percentage which Grayson Manning was absolutely meteoric. He was at 67%. This includes their game against Ohio State. Caleb Fiak checks in at number 8 at 59% after leading the country last year. No real kind of head scratchers in the top 10. Ryan Kroduk is number 6 at 59% after a slow start to the season. Sean Byrne, who we know is among the top goaltenders in the country, at number 2 with 62%. Although I would imagine that's going to cycle down a little bit by virtue of that loss to Boston University, which we will talk about here shortly. And then lastly, just to check out faceoff win percentage. I mentioned Reed Gills. He entered the weekend at number 2 with 70%. Number 1, Henry Dodge. And again, shout out to basically Virginia's game plan to muck it up with Andrew Greenspan in the second half. He finished 4 of 8, I believe. So yeah, Nick, I'm going to put you on the spot. Any performances stand out to you so far that you want to shout out?
Yes and no. Wide open field. If Entman didn't win it, I'm writing off every goalie forever until proven otherwise. I would say if I had to vote right now, my vote would probably go to Duffy.
Okay.
The highest caliber player right alongside Petrimala, I think Duffy just brings a little bit more, elevating everyone else around him. And Duffy is more of the recipient – or sorry, Petrimala is more the recipient of Duffy elevating everybody than vice versa. The best piston in the highest caliber offense in the country, to me, is kind of usually what this award represents. And to me right now, that's Owen Duffy. I will say, I think there's a, you know, honestly, it's surprising that an offense can be so well balanced. I really enjoy watching Princeton's offense. And then you look at their, you know, statistics and, you know, their top three scorers have 11, 11, and 10, according to their website, you know, Burns, Wade, and Kabiri. So I don't think anyone's kind of solidifying themselves on Princeton's offense. I don't think Notre Dame has any contenders. I really like Little John. I think he's, you know, maybe
the
most highlight reel. Why?
Because it's that's the team where my number one right now is coming from. I think Aiden O'Neill is the is what you described Owen Duffy to be. For me, Aiden O'Neill is that on a better offense, which is what I think Richmond is right now. Now, granted, I think they're also a better all-around team, but that shouldn't be a punishment. And so, yeah, I'm gonna go.
You think Richmond's a better overall team?
I do, yeah. Than Carolina.
Good for you.
Yeah. I think Notre Dame is the best team in the country. I think Notre Dame's the best team in the country right now. I think Princeton is the second best, although I thought Yale's performance in the second half yesterday was very noteworthy and something to take a lot away from. And I think Richmond is third.
UNC 4?
Yes. I think UNC and Harvard are like if they played on a neutral site, I would say right now Carolina deserves to be favored. I would probably pick Harvard. And this is coming from a guy who, don't let Terry get hot, 9-1 in my last 10 picks after starting, I believe, what would that make me? I think 6-9. Yeah. Nice. In my first 15. So,
well, if you're getting hot, now's the time to do it with March Madness, right?
Spring
around
break
the corner.
Beach body.
Yep. And you want to move on to
I do. We teased a couple
weirdest
of these games.
Game?
Yeah.
Yeah. Weirdest game of the week for me was Princeton Yale. Would you agree?
Yes. Objectively, yes. Do you want to know
okay,
why?
What happened? Yeah.
Well, yeah. Okay, so ultimately, I think the reason this is weird, there's two or three reasons, depending on how you want to parse this out, that this is a weird result. The first is that Princeton has had Yale's number for like 4 or 5 years in a row, right? So like even before this recent downturn in 2025, Yale really, really struggled with the Tigers. And also, I don't want to say before their upturn, because they obviously made it to 22 Final Four, but before like this, you know, let's just call it like this era of Princeton being like, all right, they're solidly a top five team, which is what they've been. And then the other thing is, you know, to the extent that Yale has had an issue, right, offense facing off or defense over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, it's been defense, right? So, you know, it is no surprise. I believe 7-2, I think, is the biggest that this Princeton lead got up to. But then for Yale to hold the Tigers to 3 goals in the second half and do so without a great day from Ben Friedman, who we have seen have great days so far this season, right? Like if you were to say, how did Yale hold Princeton to 11? You'd probably be like, well, Ben Friedman probably made 22 saves. Nope, he was at 50%. So it was really a combination of, and I'm going to shout out Dan Arestia. He and I were talking about this game. He was in person. The adjustments that Yale made in order to try to limit what Princeton wanted to do offensively. And one of the reasons that's so impressive and one of the things that has made it so challenging, I think the reason that Princeton has had Yale's number over the years is because, you know, we've talked about this before, but Princeton is as ardently adherent to the notion of a principles-based offense as any team in college lacrosse. And the reason that that is so difficult to prepare for and defend is because it kind of means that like anybody can shoot from any position on the field at any time. And, you know, it's a ton of two-man action. It's a ton of small-sided action. And when Yale has been good defensively, it has been because of their ability to beat you up, right? And the notion is that like these guys are both so slick and so non-scripted that there's never an opportunity to get in the phone booth. And so again, without really diving in and being able to extract exactly what Yale did defensively that slowed Princeton down, whatever they did, I have to believe was unfamiliar to Yale defense watchers. This is a group that I think has been below par at killing possessions, right? So ground balls, particularly around the crease, seem to come up disproportionately for their opponent. Multi-slide actions, you know, disproportionately end up with naked backside looks. And then lastly, and this is, I guess, this isn't what you would be familiar with if you were a Yale fan. This is what I saw, particularly from the Army game, which, you know, I think was, I don't want to call it, it wasn't their worst, it was probably maybe the most representative performance is the point I'm trying to make. What they did a really nice job of was forcing multiple passes to get from the front side to the backside, which allowed more time for backside recoveries. And, you know, I think you saw it at its best against BU in that win. But it was combined with the athletic advantage that they have. What I'm really what Yale has or had over BU I would think that they didn't have over Army. And again, like, you know, you got to keep that in context. Like Yale was handling that game early. And then to me, that was a young team that doesn't know how to win versus a team that's, you know, graduated 7 huge contributors from last year's team, but still has a lot of upperclassmen who do know how to win. And it was early in the season. And then, you know, so ultimately, again, what I'm very curious about is what Yale did defensively in order to slow down Princeton. Was it basically just matching feet and preventing them from getting good looks? Was it the organization of their front and backside support, or was it their ability to kill these possessions?
Yeah, and you know what's been interesting to me is, I think, referencing again back to that UVA Maryland game, I don't see a way in which those two teams are going to find victories against quality opponents. And to me, Princeton, this is a pretty good notch in the belt of, okay, we can weather a storm. We have the goaltender for it. We have, even in offensive stagnation and in an Ivy League matchup, and in what I think Princeton fans would probably call a lackluster performance and an inconsistent performance throughout the, you know, course of the game, certainly. To me, I came away and this is probably a stupid bias, but I'm like, okay, so Princeton can win that type of game. So Yale, you know, really struggling. I'm trying to figure out a positive spin on this for Yale, other than, yeah, you played Princeton close. Your resume isn't as bad as it might seem. And you're heading into Ivy with one of the top Ivy League teams. You nipped at their heels and had a chance to win the game. But for me, I'm starting to bucketize teams into they can win, they can't win. Princeton can.
Let's not move off the too fast. Yale's RPI is 13 and their strength of schedule is 6. And they're 3-3. So, like, you know, I'm not saying that
they lost 17-7 to Penn State, a bad loss to Army, and now Princeton.
Correct. I'm not
How
saying
much
that
weight
like
do you attribute to that.
Right now, they're not a at-large tournament contending team. But like, if you were to say that they beat Harvard, I'd be like, number one, I'm not surprised by that, and number two, like that's a really big win. So I guess my point is, like, when Yale was turning into who they became in 2018 and 2019, they did it by being the third or fourth seed in the Ivy League tournament and winning the AQ. And what I'm saying is that, like, this team, like, that's going to be who they have to be if they're going to meet their goals. And I think that yesterday's result was the most promising step we've seen in a season in which they beat BU by 5 and, you know, had to survive a scare against Fairfield.
I don't see that happening this year.
I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm saying
that's the analyst. Yeah, that's the analyst. That's what people come to the show for, Terry.
You're right. Let's keep it moving.
Let's keep it moving right into South Bend. Why not?
Yeah. How about
it? I was able to watch a good chunk of this game, and I apologize for not doing this more this week, and especially on last episode, but Michigan's last two games being against Harvard and now Notre Dame, a huge missed opportunity to call Michigan Harvard the Godfather Part 4 with Will Corrigan and Jerry Burns matchup.
Yep. Yep.
And then now I was trying to figure out, you know, what in keeping with the Oscars theme, father son. Need to go head to head. You know, I was thinking Odin, Thor, or Odin, Loki, maybe.
Yeah. You know. That's outside of my zone, but.
Yeah, I couldn't find a good one. Off the top of your head, and I'll put you on the spot, what can we compare Notre Dame, Michigan with the father, Kevin Corrigan, established, respected, versus the scrappy offensive coordinator coming into his backyard to challenge the throne?
I mean, doesn't that sound like Star Wars? I don't want to call Kevin Corrigan Darth Vader, but some officials might.
Yeah. Okay, we'll call it Revenge of the Sun. I don't know, whatever. I'll be funnier next week.
What do you got to say about this one? It was Michigan played him tight and gave him a little bit of I don't know what to call it. Like, not a scare, but, like, made him sweat a little bit at the end of the first half?
Yeah, a little bit of an uphill battle. They played but again, going back to Larkin's point last week about how this might just be the recipe for Notre Dame now. And for those wondering how the game played out, it was a rock fight. It was a tough day to find goals. It wasn't an explosive heavyweight battle, with the ball slinging around. It was objectively pretty good defense, Michigan's offense getting stagnant, and Notre Dame just, in my opinion, it was exactly what we saw in the 20 teens, which was, we're going to play a very similar style. And at the end of the day, the X factor is just going to be that we have a little bit better athletes. You know, earlier this year for my job, I was recruiting and going to a career fair at Notre Dame in Michigan. It's a noticeable difference in the size of the players. You know, you're walking around Notre Dame's lacrosse team. I don't know if you would automatically assume it's a lacrosse team. You would think it might be a specialist group for the football team, like big, jacked. And then I was able to watch Michigan's practice, and it kind of had, you know, quick, a little, maybe a little bit shiftier, But coming away from Michigan's practice, I was curious, who's going to beat the Sean Light? Who's going to be the X factor? Who's the unstoppable player? And to me, Michigan just didn't have that, and Notre Dame did.
So one of the, we've kind of touched on this for each of the last couple games. It's just the influence of the goalies. This was not a game in which one goalie performance outshined the other as a result, leading to the result. So Thomas Ricciardelli, who's coming off of a great game 2 weeks ago as well, made 11 saves, let in 4 goals. Hunter Taylor, who I cannot believe is still at Michigan based on the eligibility, is kind of like the Jake Voskal of college lacrosse for me. I don't know if you're going to get that reference. You might be a little young. 17 saves, 9 goals allowed. Based on what you saw, there's always two types of big save performances. I think, we talked about this in the context of Hopkins putting 53 shots, of which they missed all but 23. So they missed 30 shots against Syracuse, right? Like, that is the equivalent of good defense forcing bad shots. There's also good defense that forces savable shots. At each end of the field, how much do you think that was what made it a rock fight? Because I would contend, what do we got? 41 shots on goal. Like, I mean, I don't want to, that's not really a rock fight, right? Like, if they're normally at 50%, that's a 21 goal game. This was a 13 goal game because the goalies made a lot of saves. Was that because of the defense or was that because of the goalies?
I would skew heavily towards the defense. There were few and far between where I was like, wow, that was a great opportunity for either side. I think the final score was truly representative of how each defense managed itself throughout the game. Notre Dame's got consistently better and was playing a style that forced uncomfortable shots that Michigan couldn't figure out a way to make an adjustment to, whether that was swinging the ball, whether that was playing effectively through picks, whether that was trying to find skip lanes for outside shots versus – I think the Notre Dame goals just kind of ended up being, it's I'm going to sound like a broken record, but just the athleticism from the midfield drawing more weight than the matchups that Michigan could execute on throughout the game. But nothing in particular stood out to me about anything about this game. As I was watching it, I was like, oh, that was a pretty good defensive possession. Oh, that was a pretty good, defensive possession. Oh, that goal that Notre Dame scored is something that Michigan might be okay giving up. Oh, that goal Michigan got, Notre Dame's defense made them work really hard for it. I don't think that's a sustainable offensive goal that Michigan can repeat throughout the game. So if you love lacrosse, you probably didn't love this game. It reminded me of some folks when I was playing, buddies that played high school lacrosse and then, we're back together for summer break. And they're like, you play really boring games, dude. And I'm like, yeah, but we win them. And he goes, I'm not saying you're not winning them. I'm just saying, I would rather watch, Albany and the Thompsons, versus whoever else, as opposed to just fundamental defense for 4 quarters. So, yeah, it was a sweat. I don't think it was a worrisome game by any means. I think this might just be the script that we're going to see with a little bit more consistency.
All right. Got a couple more games to hit on real quick.
This game matters a lot if you're in Maryland. Hopkins versus Navy. Hopkins' offense looks good again. This is a – I'll kick it off to you.
Looks good. Yeah.
I'll kick it off to you. I'm struggling to find a way to make this game, I guess, nationally relevant. I don't think Hopkins is a serious threat. I don't think Navy's a serious threat. Was there anything in this game that you were like, interesting, this could be a problem down the road?
Well, I mean, the national relevance comes, again, not to pick up a conversation that we started last week with respect to Lars, but just in terms of, these are programs that need to win for continued stability in terms of the nature of the program. I would say, based on the conversation coming away from the Syracuse game, Hopkins needed it more in that way. I think that what's interesting is, despite our earlier conversation, like the Big Ten is going to get at least one, maybe two at-large bids. And so the question is, who's going to get them? And right now, nobody has really separated itself from, you know, like, has Rutgers, like, we haven't talked a ton about Rutgers this year. Like, has Rutgers put themselves in a position where they can feel good or strong about, like, their at-large chances? We spent a lot of time talking about Penn State and Maryland already, right? Like, you know, we just talked about Michigan. You know, we didn't talk about Ohio State because they played on Thursday, but they did add a nice win. So I guess the point is, like, all right, let's just take Ohio State's not a lock, but, you know, maybe they're in the best position so far in the league. What does that mean for Hopkins in terms of are they AQ or bust, or could they play themselves into, if the league is going to get two at-larges, they could potentially get one of them depending on who wins the AQ. And I would say that to the extent that you focus on the 14 goals as opposed to the 10 goals allowed, it's a reflection of kind of the way I felt about Pete Miliman coach teams dating back to the Cornell days. And obviously it's different if you have Jeff Teague versus if you don't. But when you are a ball movement offense, the margin is wider because the notion is that we are not going to rely on running past somebody in order to get good looks. Running past somebody does not create risk that somebody is not going to catch a pass. And that simple fact makes it more sustainable. Now, is it as good an offense? Does it create as high quality of opportunities? Does it keep everybody involved to the extent that a ball movement oriented offense does? No. And that's among many reasons why some coaches favor trying to play that style. But when it doesn't happen, when, you know, not everybody's feeling great on the same page, totally sharp, totally focused, whatever, then a lot of those passes that end up being needed to be made in order to generate those good looks end up going off the tip of somebody sticking out of bounds. It didn't happen against Navy. Now, it's not only a function of how good they felt. It's also a function of Syracuse has a bunch of defensemen who are 6'5 and play really well. And, you know, despite the fact that Navy has AJ Marsh, who I believe, you know, is kind of at that level, I don't think that they are at Syracuse's level defensively. And ultimately, that's why Hopkins is able to put up 14. And the question is, as you protract that over the Big Ten, what does that look like matchups wise, stylistically? Are they going to be able to get those good looks against Penn State, Rutgers, Maryland, based on the defensive personnel that those teams bring to the table?
Yeah, I don't know. This is the game that I know the least about. And in my current state, I would respond with something, but I think we should just crack on.
Let's do it. Last one.
Last one. Harvard-Penn. And what you shared with me prior to recording, you know, more surprising than anything else, this was another game that to me solidified that Harvard's really good, Penn's pretty good, and you know, gotta say,
that's right,
the way with which Harvard can win games and look good, and almost, they've had a couple games where they've looked dominant in long stretches of the game. And I think they're learning about how to sustain that more frequently over longer periods of time with special teams, offense, and defense stuck between a rock and a hard place, defending their offense and then not being able to generate anything, on your offensive side. So yeah. I don't know. I just came away with, you know, not a statement win. I'm not comfortable in calling it that, but just a solidifying that everything that we've thought about Harvard up until this point was justifiable and correct.
Yeah. So I have to check Harvard Penn's box scores because this looks impossibly incorrect. I just want to make sure that Inside Lacrosse's box score is not incorrect, because what I'm seeing is that Harvard combined to go 5 of 25 facing off, and that Quinn Ball was 16 of 19. Matt Eldridge came in and won 4 of 6. And if that's the case, the possession disadvantage, although Matt Baracco scored, which doesn't make a ton of sense if he didn't win a faceoff unless it was after a ground ball scrum, it is really impressive. It takes that 3-goal margin, and, you know, if you normalize it for equal possession, which Harvard, you know, Jerry Bird and coach teams have traditionally faced off very poorly, but this year so far, Harvard has had a couple of impressive face-off performances, so it's not necessarily a fait accompli that they're not going to face off well, and that you wouldn't think that in some games they'd be able to basically muster out an even possession. But the reference that you made at the top that deserves to be mentioned is Jerry Byrne was not on the sidelines for this game. I'm told that he's recovering from an operation and expected to be back really soon, including probably on the sidelines for next week. But that meant that Neil Hutchinson coached the team against the Quakers, and that in and of itself is a unique circumstance that, you know, represents a little bit of adversity that you have to overcome. You talk to anybody in the Ivy League, playing at Franklin Field always represents a little bit of adversity. And to your earliest point, like, Penn's pretty good, right? And they can get you. So I don't want to call it a survive and advance game, because I think that there's a lot of positives to be taken away from Harvard, like on the Harvard side, in terms of the way in which you battled all sorts of different types of adversity and came out on top. So I think this is a big one for the Crimson. And I would say for Penn, you know, it kind of puts you in a similar category as Penn State, maybe a step behind in the context of, like, how far away are we from where we want to be? You know, as always, they have played a tremendously tough schedule and they're 3-4. But that doesn't mean that there aren't a ton of opportunities, in the same way that I said that, you know, that was the case for a 3-3 Yale team as well. The difference being that, you know, it's first year for Taylor Ray. So there's still that proof of concept moment, as well as that everybody getting to know everybody else and seeing how they're going to battle when their back's against the wall. So a lot to be gleaned from this one, and a lot to continue to look forward to from both teams.
And then a sneaky feather in the cap too, and this does play into the psyche of the individual player. Very surprising, Harvard hadn't won at Franklin Field in 20 years.
Yeah.
That is wild. Something that looms in the back of your mind, where you're like, oh boy, this is the field that has given the generations of us prior trouble. We haven't been able to crack the code. So, yeah.
Well, but it's also like,
credit to Neil Hutchinson.
There are instances in which it can be more practical than that. Like, I watched Harvard play Maryland at Springfield High School in Delaware County in the fall, you know, really close to Penn. And I think it took them like 9 hours to get down on Friday afternoon from Boston on the bus. And, you know, I'm sure that they left a little earlier in the day than they did in the fall, because it was a spring game versus the fall game. But still, you know, presuming they didn't fly, which maybe they did, I don't know. But like, I'm sure that they had a similar type of tired leg, bus like situation when they got there. And if they did fly, they might have stood in line at TSA for 4.5 hours before they were able to board. So nothing. Wasn't able to get a laugh there? Nothing?
I mean,
I thought that when we talked about contemporary events, we just gave each other a courtesy chuckle. Thank you, Nick. That's what I was going for.
Got it.
For those that don't know, like, we got the giggles in the pre-recording session. So, yeah, I think that's a great note to end on, buddy.
I do, too. I will.
You
be
get the best supporting
week.
Actor nod this week, my man.
Oh, well, speaking of that, in my stupor last night, I didn't watch the movie because we had already just watched a movie, but my fiance went to bed earlier than me, which always gives me like 30 minutes of just brutal YouTube looking at. I just searched Best of Tombstone, Val Kilmer. The fact that he didn't win Best Supporting Actor, like, I'm going to go pretend to be him for the rest of the day. Like, oh, just gets me all fired up. And who do you have? Give me early as we wrap this up, Best Picture.
Yeah, I mean, I think One Battle is going to win, but I think Sinners deserves it. I loved One Battle. I will almost certainly rewatch it more than I will rewatch Sinners over the course of the rest of my life. But I thought Sinners was slightly more original The visual stuck with me a little bit longer, and yeah, that's what for me, I guess qualifies or defines best picture. Are you a Hamnet guy? You strike me as a Hamnet guy.
I don't know enough to know how much of a chirp that was, but hey, watch your mouth. And I'm looking up best picture nominees. I don't think I've seen a single one of them.
Which you didn't see F1?
No.
Okay. Well, you have to start with F1 so that you can understand the meme of the fireworks behind Javier Bardem at the end of the movie.
Yeah. Well, I went and saw Hoppers.
It's basically
last night. Watch that.
It's Top Gun Maverick, but in race cars. So,
I'll probably just end up watching Top Gun. And that is going to be a great time this afternoon. Terry,
thanks for getting up early today.
Love you.
Love you more.